In this week, on the 9th of April, 1988, demonstrated the awesome self-belief that carried them to the very top. The Dons came from behind to beat Luton and reach Wembley at the end of a pulsating FA Cup semi-final played at White Hart Lane. Patrick Collins, always a big supporter of the Dons, of the Mail on Sunday, could not resist a sneer when he wrote, "There was something disturbing at the sight of Vinnie Jones and his chums recklessly charging across the pitch where once Harmer and Blanche Flower and John White played the game we could understand and cherish." Well, anyhow, we love doing a little bit of an upset, and long may it continue. We're the same old Wombles. We're back.
Might not be life or death, my friend, but to me, it's more important than that.
Hello, hello, dear listener, and welcome to the Same Old Wombles podcast today. I am Matt Cooper, and I'm joined by my friend Niall Cooper. Hello, Niall.
Matthew.
And our wonderful producer with his wonderful glasses, Mr. Adam Proctor. Hello, Adam.
Evening all.
And our very special guest, we've been doing this lately, this is brilliant. Our very special guest, Mr. Eric Samuels. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well indeed.
Yes, good. Well, it's lovely to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And I think what we want to do is, it's quite interesting because we have a little bit of a preamble before we start to record, and Eric is saying that we're not going to get anything out of him. And he doesn't want to be churlish or anything. But I'm hoping through the course of this, like most people, they'll drop their guard and let out some secrets as we go along. And Eric, first of all, I mean, and it's so I've been looking back over your book altogether now, which is a fantastic read, by the way.
Thank you.
It's great stuff. And it's,
I
can
have
I
to
just.
say, I picked up This Is Our Time Today, and I think it's aged better than my book. Just going back through that, they're very different with different aims and objectives. But
There you go,
anyway,
Matt. So
just.
you'd never mention that at the start of every one of these episodes. Bring in a special guest who happens to be an author, and you go straight in, and that is that brilliant book, rather than your brother, hello, Matthew, who has written a book, a couple, three books on Wimbledon. And it takes our special guest to mention it. But Eric, I liked your book, by the way. And I
Thank
particularly
you.
like the fact that Matthew completely forgot to end your name properly, Samuel Sun, and actually it is there. So you didn't even mention the Sun.
I
So I
know.
have to say,
I've just shortened
you just
it
made
for
sure.
reasons that I can't quite understand.
I've had emails addressed, faxes in the old days when they had them addressed to Sam Wilson
And that
and various other permutations of my name.
it's
So.
because you were saying that, and I find this really sad. You were saying that, having been out of the job for 3 months, that people were stewards were asking your ID and your name, and having to spell your name to members of staff when you called up.
Well, that's, I mean, that's, but that's to be expected. I mean, I was making the point that that's to be expected.
It's not that, I mean, I think for a
How
lot of
many grounds you
people.
go to where there's a Fred Bloggs stand and you think, who the hell is that? In fact, but how many of our fans know who Jack Goodchild was? And they walk down his way every other Saturday for how many years was
Yeah.
it? About 15.
Talking about the Wimbledon legend from the 1930s, Jack Goodchild, who then went on to play for Kingstonian. The very same, surely that must be the player that we're talking about. But then I'm, of course, a sad nerd and therefore know all this sort of stuff. So,
But most people
but
don't, and
Eric,
they're quickly forgotten, and that's the point about not naming things after people, I'd say.
I have to
Anyway.
say that I will fess up that I did once spell Eric's surname with an EN at the end. And I think Eric's response was that was he actually really liked the idea of being that kind of Norwegian twinge to it, but I didn't
I'm
perhaps spell
not
it wrong. So I
sure.
have to
I'm not
fess up
sure
and be
anyone
clearing
wanted
up
to
that.
be. I'm not sure anyone wanted to be Norwegian. I don't
Well,
think
it's
that's.
not Norwegian anyway, it's Faroese.
Yeah.
They, but for what it's worth, and this is probably not worth keeping the program, my father's birth certificate, his surname is spelled S-E-N.
So there you are. But did you ever miss out the son bit altogether and just go Eric Samuel?
No, because
Didn't. No, because.
the family history, and I'm sure, I can't believe this is interesting to people, is that in the Faroes, you're named after your parents. So my children will be Ericsson. And
Oh,
so,
Not Samuelson. They'd be
Eric. If you followed their old tradition, So my great granddad, who was the first came to England, his father was called Samuel Johansson, but he was Samuelson, and that's how it worked.
Once
he came to Britain, he stuck to our rules and froze it. Anyway,
this is clearly what people tune in for the same old Wombles for. So, on further ideas, if you want any more further history on ancestry and how it works, then please tune in next week when we'll be doing another one on with Matthewson and Adamson and see where we get to. Honestly, Matt, we maybe football things.
Listen, this is what we're about. This is what makes us different. What makes us unique? We go into these sort of things. Wait until they talk about our surnames, Niall, because we're Cooper with a U, which confuses an awful lot of people. We'll save that for a special occasion. So, Eric, you obviously, and this is something I don't think a lot of football fans can understand, because you start supporting a club and that kind of, you have that club for life, I think. But you were from Sunderland and you moved down to London and you switched teams.
I did. As did Chris Stewart, just to remind you, he was a Liverpool supporter, wasn't he? Anyway, I'm pretty sure he told me that. I don't know about you, but if I watch any game, even if it's just 7 or 8 kids in a playground kicking a ball around, I have to choose a side.
Yeah, yeah.
And I started bringing my boys to Wimbledon games because for all sorts of reasons, but they wanted a local team to support and they like the colour blue. So we chose Wimbledon. And after going to, I think in one season, we went to nearly every game. You can't watch a team every game, every season, and then think, yeah, but I don't really care that much about them. You get to know them, you get to know the players. And although it's heresy where I come from, I vividly remember the day when one of my sons pointed out we were playing Sunderland and I was not shouting for Sunderland. And I thought, oh, yeah, you're right. Which was a very strange sensation and, as I say, heresy where I come from. But nonetheless, I follow Sunderland too, and I wish them every success. But Wimbledon's my team.
And I would say to most people that that's got to be one of the best bit of transfer business we ever did. and I don't think we got a fee. I don't think they got a fee. It's fantastic.
Not even a 7-day approach?
No. So it's great, and so those bits you were a fan of the club, obviously going right through to 2002. Were you involved in any other way up until that particular season, or was it you were just sort of like going along watching the games with your kids?
I used to go along with the boys and sit behind the goal in the Holmesdale Road end after the reef. Well, we went to Plough Lane too. But not that often. My first game with my family was 1987, so you can put a date on how often we could have gone to Plough Lane. I was only involved to the extent that I used to occasionally chip into the WISA chat site, where I put in some not-so-learned analysis of the Wimbledon Football Club accounts and that sort of stuff. And through those, I got involved with a group of people who were rampantly opposing Coppell. Particularly, I was asked to go to a meeting with Nicole Hammond and Peter Proto because they were struggling. They'd been threatened by Coppell for some of the things they'd said, and they wanted me to run through whether the financial analysis was right. So that was really how I got involved. And then one of my clients was Safeway, who'd bought the old Plough Lane site. So the finance director there knew I was a Wimbledon supporter and said they're about to pull down the old stand. Would I like to take some fans round, basically to steal anything they wanted? And he was genuine. No, take anything you like, but beware. The reason we're pulling it down is there's asbestos. So there's about somewhere between 10 and 20 of us went down there, including my youngest son. I remember standing on a nettle in the middle of the pitch saying, I always wanted to stand on the centre circle of Plough Lane, but not like this. I thought it was terribly poignant.
That is amazing. What did you take? Did you get anything?
I didn't take anything because I didn't feel I can't remember who else was there. I'm pretty sure Colette Mulchrone was there, people you'll know from those days. I think Mags Hutchinson was there. It was a group of that group who I think tended to go around together. I chose to take nothing. There wasn't much left by then anyway, but I didn't think it was for me to do that. I thought it was if anybody should do it, it should be them because they had the longer commitment.
It would have been Luke McKenzie and Nicole Hammond and probably Luke Carlton Kelly and those potentially that sort of group.
I don't remember exactly who was there, but I could ask them next time I see them.
Definitely. And can I ask? So the other thing that I read in your book, which is interesting, is you put together a proposal for. Is that right? If the club went into administration, how we the fans could take it over at that point.
Yeah, I did a business plan. We had various conversations. I remember talking to Lou in particular about where we might play if we were able to take the club over. And I wrote what's probably the worst business plan ever written, looking back on it with the experience of having subsequently run a football club, or what we might do and how we might take it over. But the one thing about it that I got right, and it wasn't just me, I didn't put from lots of other people, was that the only way for Wimbledon FC to survive was if we took it over, was to sell all its best players, accept a couple of relegations, and then build again from lower down the league. It was the only way I could see of us being viable. And we had forced upon us a much lower start, but that's effectively what we did. And actually, to an extent, it's what franchise did. They got rid of their best, most expensive players, didn't they? And they
Yeah.
went down a league or two.
Yeah, all three. It's that's but that is fascinating. Do you think if it was actually happened, we could have taken over? Do you think that we could have run it? If at the end of that season that Coppell and Neil had walked away and it gone into administration, do you think we could have made a fist of it and stayed at Selhurst, for instance?
Not on the plan I wrote. No, it wasn't realistic. We'd have had the we'd have inherited. Well, actually, let's see. If you take over a club in administration, I'm not sure what your position is with players' contracts, but we'd probably been taking over players' contracts, which tend to survive, I think, for money that we just didn't have and couldn't afford. So I think it. What happened was a disaster. Should not have happened. But if it was going to happen, that was probably better that it happened that way than that we took over a club that would have died in our hands.
Yeah.
The way it works is that with the player contracts in the EFL is they have a protection that you have to honour the player's contract. Everything else is can be up to 1p in the pound or whatever. So that's the bit that often causes clubs strife, and that's where you
Yeah,
get the
that's
fire
right. I
sales.
remember because you don't have to honour the manager's contract.
Yeah.
I remember reading that and thinking, "Oh, that's a bit rough."
Yeah, so there's a particular clause that I was made aware of when Fair Game first started. It was just looking at that and going, that is just bonkers, because it's you had a situation where Wayne Rooney was playing at Derby or something. Derby were going to administration, but they still had to pay Wayne Rooney £90,000 a week or something, and it was just just insane, because that was actually you're sacking most of your staff, your backroom staff, because they've got to honour the contracts of their star player. So that's the
Yeah.
situation that we would have been in.
It
But
was. I mean, I think it wasn't be viable. The other thing which is always it annoys me. This is slightly contentious because obviously we start that season in 2002, 2003. By the end of 2000, that season, they've gone into administration, and I think there was always that thing of why didn't we buy the club at that point? We were up and running. Why didn't we then decide to buy that thing? And for me, I think at that point, I was almost celebrating the fact that they were in administration and that our club was up and running. We by that point we were already Wimbledon, and the idea of getting involved with that other side were wasn't it? But I didn't know whether there was any talk or thoughts.
No. Well, certainly not that I was aware of. I think my view is like you, is that that was now history. I'm pretty good at letting go, and I'd let go and moved on. And if I'm brutally, I mean, one of the questions I struggle with is people say, aren't you glad it happened? You've had such a good time. And the answer is, no, it really, really shouldn't have happened. And I very much regret that it did. But having happened, yeah, I've had a great time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we all feel the same. I mean, for us, there's still an awful lot of anger. And we are those supporters that won't never go to their ground. And Niall, I don't think we'll ever go and watch much in the way of a home game when they're playing. Did you ever have to go to their place?
No, I just refused. Even when the EFL held a meeting there, I just didn't go. And I think I'm guessing that David Charles, who used to go with me at these meetings, who was then the club secretary, I'm guessing he went alone. I wouldn't go. I've never been, and I won't go. And I respect the views of, you know, I respect there's a whole range of views about what you should do. But for me, I can't do that. And I won't do that. I used to watch the home games because that was my job.
Yep.
I think I had to be there. And now I think I go because, well, actually, I say I'm sort of moved on, and then I remember how I reacted when Curtis scored that goal.
Yes.
Last season.
Yeah.
And thinking, I do care, really, don't I? A lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
I think that will, that moment will just will live forever. It's one of it. It's going to now be Wimbledon of folklore. It was just the most amazing, amazing feeling in football.
Yes. One of my favourite quotes is from Dame Edna Everidge, who said that she had this wonderful gift, which is the ability to laugh at the misfortune of other people.
Yes.
And that's probably how I feel about the franchise.
Yeah.
I try not to look at their results, but I am always
aware. I know. I think we're the same.
Eric, I'm still the kind of, it's mathematically still possible they might get relegated. That's where I'm at.
That's
right. No, I did the sums a while ago and concluded it wasn't going to happen.
Very unlikely. Very unlikely. They're 12 points clear.
Yeah, you see, Nah knows. But can I ask, going all the way back to our first season, when did you get involved with the club? Because I was looking through and I saw you actually approached the club, said they need a financial director.
Well, the club at that time, I think, was Chris and Ivor, effectively, as far as I could see. And I don't quite know how it came about, but I remember Ivor and Chris coming to my house, and we had a loft room then with incredibly steep eaves, and we had to sit looking at my computer with Ivor under the steepest part of the eaves because the other two of us couldn't fit in there. And we went through verse. This is when I was doing this business plan. So how I got to that stage, I honestly don't remember. But having got the stage where I knew them and I'd done this plan for taking over the club, the next step was to say to them, well, you will need a business plan for the new club that you just founded. And honestly, it is so unlike me. I said, I think you need a finance director and that should be me, which it's just not me. I don't do that sort of thing. I'm ever so pleased I did, but it's totally out of my normal character.
That was amazing. And were you... Sorry, Noel.
I have to say, having been around at that point when all this was happening, I think it was a very, very good decision. And so I've got to say a big thank you, Eric, because I think for me, watching that first year unfold and being there in the offices and all kind of around the periphery of the kind of centre circle where everything was happening at Wimbledon at the time, it was really obvious that we needed somebody like you, Eric, to kind of make sure that we were not being a bunch of numpties. So I think, you know, from my
well,
personal
I can do a lot numpty of myself, lot. You know. thanks, Niall. I didn't mean to cut across you. I think I did. I've never actually asked Ivor why did he say yes. But then when you remember how he made Luke McKenzie, the security officer, the safety officer, by just ringing him up and saying, you're a big lump, how about being safety officer? And I think it's probably as much thought went into my position as Luke's. So whatever, I think effectively it was Ivor who said yes. And maybe if there's any thought behind it, was perhaps somebody with a city, big professional accounting background might add a little bit of credibility to some of the things they're trying to do. but I'm not sure it was really that well thought through. I think it was just, yeah, okay, jump on board.
I think that's what it was at the start, wasn't it? There was because it was moving at such pace.
It was
that no one, they wouldn't have time to put out official adverts or recruit people that way. If you came forward and you had a skill, you would be jumped on. So I think the fact that you said, you know, I could do this and this is my background, I don't think there would be a hesitation in getting involved.
I stayed on as a partner at PwC for another a year and a half. I didn't retire from there till the end of 2003. But honestly, I sat in my office there mainly doing stuff about Wimbledon. Totally wrong. But having announced that you're going to leave a place like that, they gradually take all your clients off you because they want proper continuity. So I suppose I'm trying to justify the fact that basically I was freeloading for a year and a half.
Yeah, you can't justify it. It's just what you were doing, Eric. It's fine. So were you doing that particular role for the club? I mean, obviously you were with PwC, but after you left, were you doing that on a voluntary basis?
Yeah, I never really thought about it. I mean, how can I put this? I always felt, you know, imposter syndrome looms large in my life, and as much in PwC as anywhere else, where I could never understand why anybody was paying me what they did. And so when I retired, I was in a position, having been fortunate as an employee to have accumulated a decent pension, that I didn't really need it. I didn't really need any income. And perhaps, it's easy to rationalise your thoughts later as to why something happened, but perhaps I was thinking, if I stay free, they won't boot me out. Whereas if I start saying, you need to pay me, they might say, oh, hang on, we need a volunteer here. So maybe there was something in that.
But I do recall, though, Eric, weren't you actually getting paid, and I believe, wasn't the annual salary a guinea?
Oh, yeah, true? But that wasn't then. That was when I was made chief executive. The chairman of the Don's Trust at the time was David Cox, and he said, quite rightly, that if you're going to have a position, then there needs to be a contract. And for a contract to be legal, there needs to be an exchange of value, like money. And normally it's a pound. So I said, and that's when I said, well, you know, a guinea sounds posher. So that was 2007, probably. And there's no resentment in this, but I do have to say that they never paid me. On the other hand, I never signed the contract, so that's probably fair.
I think you should totally be getting a guinea, at least.
Well, Ian McNay, Cherry Red Records, extraordinarily generous man, at one of the volunteer away days, gave me a real gold guinea as a thank you. And that's in my wife's jewel case. I take it out occasionally and look at it, which is really very generous of him and amounts to significantly more than the club owes me for whatever it was, 12 years at a guinea a year.
We should have a guinea.
A guinea, though, is not a guinea, £1 and 5 pence.
21 shillings in old money, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So but a gold guinea is if I was cheapskate enough to look up how much it cost, the answer would probably, I'm guessing, the answer would probably be, well, that was when I don't know when it happened, but probably in the several hundred pounds value, I'm guessing.
But I'm just putting out there to our listener that Eric was involved with the club for 12 years. So he's owed 12 years of a guinea, 12 guineas. So that, I reckon, accounts for about 2 pints in the Phoenix. So, dear listener, when you next see Eric, I'll hear 2 pints, and that will cover his...
But like the guinea, I can't take it because I'm teetotal.
Oh, you have to be like me, buy a Sprite or something. I remember once reading that you...
A yard of lemonade.
You had ice cream.
Eric, that's a fantastic story that you've got that guinea. I think every now and again you should lend it to the museum. That's a lovely piece.
Oh, never occurred to me.
That's what you were. That's your payment was this gold guinea that kindly Ian McNay gave you. That's fantastic.
Well, I think payment. I don't think it was. I thought it was just a very generous gesture from an extremely kind man. A good man.
That's fantastic. So you were finance director for the first few, and when did you become the CEO? 2007?
I think I became acting CEO when Chris resigned, and I think it was 2007. And then I think it was the following, they went, I did it until the end of the season, I think. And I think I was then appointed full time, permanent rather, because it was full time from the beginning, really. I was appointed permanently the following April or so, but I'd need to go back and look all that up to check if that's the exact date. It's round about then,
Yeah.
near enough. I did it until April 2019. So it's
That's
6 years since I stopped, which I find astonishing.
that feels weird. That feels weird to think of, like, because honestly, because for us who were kind of involved with all that AFC Wimbledon at the start, all three of us in various different ways, like to think of you not actually having not been actively involved for 6 years just seems. It seems like yesterday, Eric, to be honest.
Well,
So,
I did a couple of years as a tour guide, a little while, and I did a couple of years. I continued on as the chairman of the foundation, but as the club itself, as I said earlier, I'm good at letting go. I really thought the right thing to do was, I always say I didn't want to be the Alex Ferguson sitting at the back of the stand with my arms folded, glowering and looking as if it was
what would you
my day. It's just you have to step away.
say, Eric, out of all of that, out of your 17 years kind of being there in the centre of it all, would be two things. One would be your personal highlight on both on the pitch and off the pitch. And is there one individual that you think is an unsung hero?
Ooh, I wish you'd given me notice of this.
And whatever
I
you
was
do,
talking.
don't say Niall.
Still with me, is it?
I
Clearly,
was talking to
is
Eileen
it?
earlier.
All the time he fishes.
I was talking to Eileen earlier about what were the best moments. And they're probably the small things. I can't remember the game, but I do remember a game at King's Meadow where it was towards the end of the season and we'd had a good season. I'm not sure whether we're going to get promotion that season or not. I was sitting at the back of the director's box with Ivor and team came out and the place was full or pretty well full. There was a hell of a noise. I remember turning to Ivor and saying, "What on earth have we done?" Which it was just most of the time this doesn't register with me. I go to Plough Lane, it's a nice stadium, but I don't relate it to me. I find it very difficult to see the link. But that was once one of the ones that sort of flattered my ego, and I do have an ego, and I do like it flattering. Was when the chairman of the EFL said he was going to stand aside when we won promotion to League One at Wembley, so that I could be next to the trophy when it was handed over because he was so impressed with what we'd done. I want to stress it was we, not me. And I thought, wow, that was a really nice touch, I thought. So I appreciated that. And it was lovely to have my then 5-year-old granddaughter with me, who said it was the best day of her incredibly short life at the time. Actually, and one of the
That's
highlights of that
amazing.
was
Oh.
we went up on the big screen. The picture was on the big screen, and one of
Yeah.
the teaching assistants at her school, who had no idea who she was, was, "What? What the hell's she doing there?" Thought that was lovely.
Is beautiful. What gorgeous moments. I mean, I'm going to have to ask you some troubling things because obviously you oversaw a lot of changes of managers in that time. I mean, was that difficult when you were involved in, like, for instance, Neil Ardley, the sacking of Neil Ardley, or
Sacking Neil
Terry
Ardley
Brown?
was one of my biggest regrets. Not the fact that we sacked him, because I think it got to a point where he and I both agreed it was time. But the way we did it was totally against my views of how you should do things, and I still feel uncomfortable when I think about it. I've always said that you read in the papers, and maybe the papers just make it up. That the manager's got 3 games to save his job. And if that's what the board think, then they should sack him now. What the hell are you giving him 3 games for across the whole of his time in the club and what he might achieve? How many more games are you going to give him after those three? If you get to that stage, you should sack him. And we were arguing, Yeah, arguing, not just debating, arguing in the board as to what to do. And I was saying I wanted, I think, my recollection is I was saying I wanted Neil to have more time. Memory isn't perfect, but my recollection was I thought he could sort us out. Eventually, I was persuaded, I allowed myself to be persuaded, I won't blame anybody else, that we should effectively tell him that he really needed to sort things out within three or four games, which is the antithesis of what I believe in. It's just wrong. It's insulting, and it means you've made your mind up anyway. So why the hell don't you just sack the guy? And then you both emerge, importantly for him too, with some dignity. We did that really badly, really badly. And I apologised to him more than once about that.
God, I was on the board, Eric, when that was happening, on the Bonds Trust board, and having very similar conversations. I really remember that. And it was hard. Really hard.
I get on well with all, well, not quite all our former managers. The first one perhaps doesn't rate me so highly. but, you know, I not every year, but most years, Terry Brown comes to the Oval to the test match with me and my guest. I regularly chat to Dave Anderson. I see Neil for lunch, not regularly, but you know, once in a while. Stay in touch with Simon Bassey. So yeah, I they're good people. They were never my mates, because I don't think you can have people as your mates when they work directly for you. And similarly with the players, I don't understand this need to be mates with the players. You want to be able to talk to them and have them talk to you, but they're not my friend.
Yeah,
it can't work that way. It shouldn't work that way. Self-indulgent, yeah, so if you question. Do.
Question that you didn't answer was the unsung hero.
Oh, and I'm not saying this for my own security, but actually, what Eileen put up with over those years deserves some kind of medal. She really did. I mean, we were talking earlier about the early days of the Donstrass board, and I don't think you're on it at the beginning, Niall, where it was almost like warfare. And coming home from that, spitting feathers and tearing what little hair I've got out after meetings the first couple of years. And part of the trouble was that board had been elected not to own a football club. They'd been elected before AFC Wimbledon was formed. And it was incredibly frustrating. You'd probably better ask her what she put up with. But the number of holidays we ruined, not least the... when I was talking to her about it again today, the St. Albans saga, where we were effectively accused of fraud over the gate. And I was going on holiday when the letter arrived. Not a great holiday, that one.
What? I don't remember this. What happened there?
We played them in the FA Cup, and we had a crowd of, and I'm making these numbers up, we had a crowd of, say, 1,800, and they sent us a formal letter sometime afterwards saying the crowd was at least 3,000, and they had objective evidence to prove that it was, and they wanted us to, I forgot what they wanted. Did they want, I think, that you are entitled, although it's rarely called for, you're entitled to call for evidence of what the gate was, what the ticketing sales were, all that sort of thing. And so I went on holiday with the whole pile of information, because I was best placed to do it, and produced in great detail a file, quite thick anyway, quite a thick file. Oh, the fact that they'd done this got leaked to the St. Albans, whatever it's called, the St. Albans Times. Yeah. And you know, it came out so quickly, it had to come from the club. And Chris Stewart said, quite rightly, because he's a shrewd guy, he said, "I knew you would take this personally, Eric." And I did. I did, took it very personally. Anyway, I produced a file and we sent it off to the FA and a copy to St. Albans. And sometime later, I think that the then chairman rang me up for a reference for Dave Anderson, because they appointed him briefly as a manager some years later. And I mentioned it to him and he said, "Well, you just sent me all that paper." I do remember that the outcome was that there was a mistake and we owed them something like £13.75. and I wanted to take one of those big fuck-off checks with me and present it to him outside the ground and get the non-league paper to be there. But then I thought, no, it's not very dignified, is it? But I really, really wanted to do that.
Oh, that, God, I wish you had done that. That would have been brilliant.
I wish I had, but it's not me, really. That's the trouble. It's not me.
Can I, because we had, you know, there were periods of time we had issues going up for the league. I mean, I remember particularly the Jermaine Darlington, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been horrendous. What was that like?
I remember I didn't have an office at King's Meadow. I think I worked, I'm pretty sure I worked just at a table in the President's Lounge. And I remember Trevor coming in and basically telling me and sitting with his back against the bar there with his head in his hands. But he realised immediately what he'd done, far quicker than I did, because I didn't understand the rules. And then we did what we always do at that time in such despair. We rang David Barnard, who, for listeners who aren't familiar, he used to be the chief executive at Wimbledon FC, and he's been a long-term board member at Chelsea. But as he always says, when Mourinho asked him how his team had done today, he didn't mean Chelsea. It was always about us. And David was incredibly helpful, put us in touch with Jim Sturman, the top lawyer, who came and argued the case for us. And I know that we had various boardroom encounters with other clubs after this had happened. The message from all of them was, you're screwed. You'll be kicked out of the trophy, it must have been, straight away, which we were. Yeah. And you'll lose whatever points it is. And indeed we did, first time round. And then we had various monstrous board meetings, which we decided very, I think, naively, that if we had to, we'd go to the, what's it called, the Council for the Arbitration in Sport? CAS, anyway. I'm not sure what the C stands for. But actually, we held that meeting at Jim Sturman's offices. They don't call them offices when they're barristers, do they? They call them, anyway, whatever.
Chambers.
Yes, chambers. Yeah, in a big room, one of his chambers. Sounds a bit saucy, doesn't it? Anyway, he suddenly got really very angry with the decision that had been made and the logic, when the decision was published, you get a letter setting out the logic. And he said, well, we're going to appeal this. And fine, climb on board. And when we went to the appeal, the committee comprised Neil Doncaster, who was then the chief executive of Norwich, but also it was something on the FA, a guy from non-league whose name escapes me now, but I did interview him for my book, and a third person. How embarrassing, I can't remember. But anyway, I remember it started with them inviting Alan Turvey to make the case. And I remember he and Nick Robinson, who was the Ryman League secretary at the time, looking at each other, trying to decide who's going to speak. And I thought, you're not even prepared. So they spoke. And then Neil asked questions like, do you think this is a fair penalty? And I began to think, maybe the tide is changing. And then we were thrown out and to wait while they deliberated. Jim went off to talk to Alan Turvey, and I sat twiddling my thumbs in the corner, answering texts from people asking what was going on. Went back in and he started by announcing that the Ryman League had made the right decision. However, they're going to reduce it to 3 points. And I thought Turvey was going to explode. Honestly, he was bright red. And I didn't mean it quite so badly, but I was still sitting outside. I went outside and sat there, and Neil Doncaster left. As he walked past me, I said, did I hear that right? Honestly, Neil, is that what happened? Yes. And then Alan Turvey went past, and there was a protest group outside. I remember. And I said to him, you needn't worry, Alan. Now we've been found. Now we're okay. They won't have a go at you. And he went berserk. He absolutely really laid into me. I didn't mean to. Well, yes, I did mean to wind him up. Let's be honest about it.
But he's he's a weird character in our history, isn't he? Because in one sense, there he was. Yeah, Turvey was one. You know, he was the one person who who voted against the relocation, and then here he is at this other point. I guess he's got in his warped mind a feeling of right and wrong.
I don't think it was warped. I think he had a particular view of the world, which is different from yours and mine. And he had a very traditionalist view. He used to lay into us and to blame me for not wanting to wear ties at home games. I remember him came to a meeting and the conversation was about security for some game of the coming season. Yeah, maybe we were about to join the Ryman League, but it very quickly went on to the fact that we don't wear ties in the boardroom. Really strange.
Wow.
And years later, I spoke to someone I interviewed for my book who was quite high up in the FA, said that they talked to Turvey about us, and he said within minutes he was talking about ties. I don't know. Seriously. And Chris Stewart was fine. He said, when we go to away games, we'll respect the rules of the opposition, but at home games, we don't wear them. And I talked to Andy Walsh of FC United, who was my counterpart there, and they were told that they must wear ties in the boardroom. So they, he said they used to bring the opposition directors in and say, that's the boardroom, but we don't go in there because we're not wearing ties.
That's very Andy Walsh. I've met Andy Walsh before. It's very Andy. When we were talking before we came on air, Eric, one of the things you mentioned, and it's something I can't let go, was the film script.
Yes.
I definitely want to know this for our listener. There has always been this kind of mythical, in my mind, mythical story film script that was being produced, and our story was going to hit the big screens. And Eric, I think you should just take it from here, because I never thought it actually even happened.
No, I didn't think it. I didn't think it had been written at all. I thought that it.
Oh yeah, it got written. I've got copies of at least two versions of the script. I've forgotten quite how I came to here, but I'm assuming that it was initiated by John Green, who, having had big success with The Fault in Our Stars and is it Searching for Alaska or
something like that. Listen, we'll ask him when he comes on, because he's promised to be on the podcast several times.
He had big success with film, so he had a lot of clout with Fox Pictures. So yeah, it wasn't just Fred Bloggs with a video camera down the road. It was a big company, and he presented to them, which included the penalty shootout. He did presumably it was a slideshow full of, and ended with the penalty shootout to show the drama of it. And the story I heard, which I can only assume I heard from him, was that it caused some confusion in the room, because one of the vice presidents of Fox said, this is just too complicated. There's four teams on the pitch. There's the guys in blue, there's the guys in orange, there's the guys in green, and the guys in whatever colour their goalie was wearing, Mark Tyler was wearing. They thought the goalies were separate teams.
Oh, my giddy aunt.
So, nonetheless, he persuaded them and came across, and we were asked to sign a contract. And I was extremely reluctant. I was against it for a number of reasons. One was I didn't want to put myself in that position. Secondly, I thought that whatever happened, they were going to try and compact 9 years into an hour and three quarters. And not possible. All right, I know you've written a play that did that, Matt, but nonetheless.
Oh, no, I didn't do 9 years. Mine was deliberately a season.
Okay, I did see the play, but I only saw the first version of it time ago. Yeah. So apologies for that.
That's all right.
And I thought what was bound to happen was that some very worthy people would be left out.
Yeah.
And I just thought, and I knew what would happen also, that one or two people would say that the film was just a vehicle for particular individuals within the club. Because you know how it works with the press and with TV and whatever, they pick on the larger-than-life characters. And that's what would happen. So I thought, this is just not right. I don't like it. I don't want to sign it. But I was persuaded to, because one of the mantras was, what's the best thing for the club? And the club was guaranteed, I've forgotten the sums, but several people were given contracts to sign. There was me, Chris, Ivor, Simon Bussey, because the original script had it that John drafted had it starting in a taxi driven by Simon and somebody chatting to him.
Yeah.
That was John's original, that's his original not script. There's a word they use for describing the arc of this picture. What is the, anyway. So he didn't go into detailed script, but he did have a storyboard type thing.
Uh-huh.
So Simon had to sign. I think Danny Kedwell had signed. Danny rang me up later and asked if he could play himself.
Wow. That's mad.
And we signed, and the club got some money. I could look it up, but I'm guessing the club got £25,000, £45,000, so, and a further sum if it got, if they took up, it included an option, and then a further sum if it got made. And so I got a few thousand pounds, and then when they took up the option, because they still hadn't got anywhere with it, I got a few more thousand pounds, and so did the others. So I did more than get my guinea a year, you could argue. And it went through various iterations, but my understanding of how it fell apart, and you can ask this of John Green, was that basically they'd appointed a Brit who lived in America to write the script. I think it's from Newcastle, anyway, from the north of England somewhere. A football fan who loved our story. They'd found a director, but he basically had the script writer who'd come up with the script. And as I said to you before this started, I got a copy of the last script that we saw. They had, so he was pulling it in one direction, John Green was pulling it in another, and the studio were pulling it in another. And my predictions were right in that the studio was saying, well, there's not enough female interest in here. So they decided to big up the role of a woman in the story. And there's not enough interest for young people. So they wrote a young person into the story. And I was thinking, this is just bollocks. I was becoming less and less convinced, but I thought it's going to happen. But then eventually we came to the end of the second option and they chose not to come back and ask again, to my immense relief. It caused a lot of fun because people were talking about who's going to play who. And if you ever want to annoy Ivor, just to say it should have been Danny DeVito. Because I used to get to him. He would always say Joe Pesci. Pesci?
Yeah.
Everybody seemed to think Bill Nye should be playing me.
For St. Eric.
Eric, what was your bit? What was your bit in it? You were saying before that you have a...
Oh, there was a bit of... I mean, they're trying to show... You know, I'm the chief executive. I've seen us through to four of the five promotions, I think. I may be doing Chris Stewart a disservice there, but I think it was four of the five, maybe three of the five. But I don't think the writer really knows what a chief executive does. So I'd need to go back to the script, but I got a feeling that basically the business expertise that I demonstrated was me leaning over someone's shoulder and correcting a spreadsheet. That was it.
Eric, I really want to see this script.
No, it's not going anywhere. There are various things I've got that are not going anywhere. Some of which
you've got.
And one of which I'll tell you after this finishes, but I don't want to make the person hear about it.
What was the working title?
Oh. I mean, you can't pause this while I go and look it up.
No. But I've just you'll have to text us. We'll put it out on socials, and the two people that follow us can find out. But it's that's just hilarious. I would love to see that. I'd love to see what they did with the woman's role. What role did they have all of a sudden?
I think, and to be fair, because she didn't get much of a role, I think they expanded Lou Carlton Kelly's role.
That's good. That'd be brilliant.
It had a logic about it, which, yeah, to be fair.
Yeah. But that would have been brilliant. But, I mean, I just wondered if they made that as sort of like a love interest or whatever. Suddenly Lou was like...
No, I don't think there was a love interest. I think it was just, you know, this is all... white men, basically, I suppose, they were thinking.
Well, no, to be honest with you, in actual fact, I think that the idea of having Lou's in, I mean, we've spoken to, I mean, Lou, I think, was an unsung hero. She did a load of great stuff. And speaking to Nicole Hammond as well, she did some brilliant stuff. So, you know, women have played a huge part in our club.
They have indeed.
Yeah, but it's, But it's interesting because I just wondered how the female role would have been developed, and I have a feeling it would probably not be developed. It would probably not be developed the way that it should have done. Do you know what I mean?
You could have had Eileen, Matt. That's the point. And then you would have had a love interest.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, we all had a love interest, and he said smoothly in our club.
Yeah. Oh, I love it.
Oh.
and the young person, that would have been interesting. I wonder what they'd have done to try and make it
appear. No, I don't know exactly about that, and I'm not telling you.
Ah, damn it. Seb Brown. It could only be Seb Brown. Seb Brown, because he was a young supporter of the club.
It was a fan. It was a fan.
Wow. I tell you, one day, this is...
No. I should instruct in my will, it should be destroyed.
Because I'm understanding, talking of, there are two things that think about film, because I'm understanding, is there something coming out on Netflix? I believe that there's something coming back out on Netflix later on in June. I think they're going to re-look at the Crazy Gang story. I heard something about that.
You know as much as I do. I mean, one of the things that I said about letting go is I don't wander around the club asking questions, so I don't know.
Yeah, I have a feeling.
Anyway, if it's a Crazy Gang thing, it wouldn't necessarily be much around the club.
Yeah, and also the other thing I noticed the other day was on the TV on the film the TV detective series Grace, they used Plough Lane.
I've not seen it, but I'm told that they CGI'd an extra stand.
I had to watch it.
I was waiting for people to go onto the Womble Underground Press and complain about what a waste of money it was, and that would never be fitted out.
it was hilarious watching that, and you know, I think they were sitting right near our seats as well, which was quite funny to see.
We have watched Grace, but we tend to wait till the end of a series before we start watching it, so we'll keep that one on the back burner for now.
Oh, it's good. It's good, and it's I mean, and now you can see what our stadium's going to look like in a few years' time.
Maybe.
Yeah, but there was all sorts.
Aaron,
I mean,
what would be? I was going to say, Eric, what would be on the stat, on the development of the ground, what would be the first bit that we should do if we were able to?
Well, it would, you're going to get an accountant's answer, which it depends. You know, I said in the book, and there's no secret about it, that we got some quite detailed negotiations with London Irish at one point, and they were going to put, from memory, $7 million into the club, of which a chunk was had to be spent on developing the East Stand because they need 10,000 capacity. And also, I think they also needed some more drinking capacity, although that's my interpretation. but, you know, and it would have been a good deal. We were never sure whether they were using us as a stalking horse for a better deal with Brentford or whether they really meant it. But I spoke to the then CEO at the time, later, and he said that no, they were for real. They thought that a really good synergy between the location and the size and the sort of the personalities, but we just overestimated the depth of their pockets, was the expression he used. So if that came back again, and I believe there's things afoot in the rugby world, isn't it? If London Irish or somebody similar came back again, then that would be the one to do. The popular one to do would probably be the South Stand, wouldn't it? You could build it back to the back wall of the flats because that's all our land. And I guess, I don't know how much, it would also take away, I mean, I assume you've been in the hospitality area and seen that there are various seats where you have no view of the goal at that end.
Yeah.
Because the roof being so low. But you had to build that corner around anyway in order to build the hospitality area. So it would please those people or people who could sit there. And I think that would be a popular thing to do. But you'd really need to look at where's the demand coming from. Is it coming from younger people, younger families? And if so, again, I think you do the East Stand. The last one to do is the away stand. You could go up to 13,500, I think, before you'd have to do anything about the away stand because they're entitled to 10% of the capacity for league games. 15% for FA Cup games, so I'm not sure how you'd fix that, but that's few and far between.
Yeah, that's interesting, though, because I think a few people have thought that it would be better to do... Some people talk... I mean, there's all arguments for different stands, but some people thought the away stand would be one to do first because if we were going up through the leagues, hopefully, we would have more away fans coming.
I don't think there'd be that many teams who'd bring 13, 14, or 13, 50, I think it is, that end. I think it's the most constrained part of the ground for expansion.
And definitely not, like, I think that's a really bad idea to the away end, actually.
I'm not sure what the position is with the East Stand, because when we were, this is quite an arcane subject, but in the negotiations with Galliard, they were very worried that what's now, I think, a lovely pedestrian area behind the East Stand, tree-lined and everything, would become just a narrow wind tunnel and quite dark and depressing, because the stand over there can be the same height as the main stand, which is 17 metres. So we negotiated all sorts of things, one of which was that if we wanted to change the wall of that stand, they had to give their approval. Not unreasonably withheld, but they had to give their approval. And when we came, as Buckingham quite rightly pointed out, there was no need to build a 17-metre high wall when we were only going for 9,500 initially. We had to go to Galliard to say they need their say-so. And they were pushing back and saying, well, okay, but in return, we want to widen that pedestrian area, which I think has been widened. Whether we had to give up that land permanently or whether it's just an understanding till we build the 17 metres, I don't know. I'm guessing we gave it up, but I genuinely don't know. But it has reduced the space at the back of the current East Stand for expansion, probably reduced the potential capacity from 20,000 down to a lower number. Lord knows what it would be.
Eric, we can't. Plough Lane was the crowning glory. I mean, that was just amazing for that to happen. When did you first get a sense that it was possible for us to move into to that ground?
Oh, I don't know about that ground, but when we won promotion, when we won the Conference South, which I still call it that, I can't get out of the habit. We were called yet again to a civic reception, which was bananas, really, especially in the combined counties. And I was there were various conversations went on with Tom Adam, who possibly was the chair of the Dunsworth Board at the time, and Ivor from council members, who were saying things like, we need to do to get you back to Wimbledon. And I didn't have this conversation with anybody, so I was imagining there's just a lot of hyperbole in this, and I wouldn't have it. I didn't believe them. So it was very fixed in my mind how comprehensively wrong I was. I spoke at some length later to Andrew Judge, who was badly maligned, when over the Merton wouldn't help Wimbledon FC to find a new stadium. And he said there was a conscious decision that actually this would be good for the borough. And he personally felt motivated to try and do something about it, because he felt, A, Wimbledon FC had been treated badly by Milton Keynes and co, and the FA, and B, he wanted to put right what he thought was very unfair treatment of the council. So he had that. I think Stephen Allen Brittis, who was by then the leader of the council, had a much more business hat on and thought, actually, there's a chance here for Wimbledon being quite a sporting borough, and Merton being quite a sporting borough. And this lot beginning to look like they're serious. They're in the conference now, so it can start to be credible. So you went from the face palm, we would go and say we want a new stadium, and they'd say, yeah, sure, show us what you're thinking of doing and we'll talk to you about it, to how can we help? Which is just sea change, barely describes it. It was extraordinary. It didn't take long for me to realise I'd been an idiot and should have listened to Ivor and Tom. And then away we went.
That's incredible. And at that time, were there other options on the table, or was the Greyhound track the only viable option?
We'd done various surveys. I've got a copy of a report somewhere that I think covered, is it 19 potential venues, one of which was Kings Meadow, but it was the only one outside the borough. This is done by the guy who did an awful lot of work in the background, for which never probably been thanked, Roger Hopkinson, who twisted arms, I think, at his then employers to help us to come up with this report. And I think, I'd need to read it again, I think from memory they concluded that Plough Lane was one of three likely ones, but it had some major downsides, one of which was that we didn't think Risk Capital Partnerships, who owned it, would ever talk to us. But in the end, they did a deal with Galliard for not just that Greyhound Stadium, but for various other ones across the country, as they owned six or seven. And so then it was Galliard. And years later, the guy I spoke to at Galliard, a man called Mike Watson, told me that he went to see Stephen Allen British, and the message was basically, if you want to build a stadium, if you want to build, develop this site, you need to help AFC Wimbledon. And he slipped a, Stephen slipped a piece of paper across the desk to Mike, which had my phone number on. I didn't know this. And that's where they got in touch. Which started with us saying, no, we can't, because we already had done a deal with Stephen Sexton. Anyway, someone else we'd done a deal with, believing that he could help us build a stadium there. We had a standoff for about 6-9 months while, because we had a contract to honour.
Yeah.
And then it took off.
Wow. And I mean, Eric, we started this whole thing in the preamble going, you saying, I'm not sure there's much for us to talk about. But I generally feel that there's a whole other section here because I've got a whole list
of things that I made a note of that I might manage to throw in. I think I should throw one in so far.
Exactly. I mean, I'm just, again.
These are all trivia and fun things.
The whole thing with Boris Johnson as well, because, I mean, that set us back. And I was interested to read in your book that apparently the reason he stopped it was because there was a waitress at the GLA who was into greyhounds.
That was one of the explanations he allegedly gave. I was told not to repeat that, but I can't honestly think I could do any damage to Boris Johnson's reputation. And the person who told it to the person who told me wouldn't have the slightest interest. But so it's probably not. It's probably as true as most things Boris Johnson said. How about that?
Okay.
I'm told he said it. I've forgotten that, but thank you for that. Yeah,
that it's in the book, so I feel like I'm okay saying it.
I did once think that I should hold some dinners for people to tell them stories I didn't dare put in the book, but I thought that would be equally subject to slander as opposed to libel, so I better not.
I know, and obviously the one thing that you mentioned in the book, and we won't push you on it, or will we? Is Wally Downs, because again that would have been a difficult time.
Well, I left while he was still in position. It wasn't me who moved him on, and I wasn't there when the betting thing came up. Well, he's very personable. Well, anybody who's met him knows how personable he is and great fun.
Yeah.
But I was never comfortable. I actually thought that was not the right appointment. And people will say he saved us, and there's no question that we were saved, and he was the manager, so he saved us. Would we have been saved anyway? I have no idea. You'll never know. But I was uncomfortable with that. And so when it ended the way it did, I wasn't completely surprised. A great shame, because, you know, he could have stayed on and made an even bigger name for himself, but there you go. And I never ask questions at the club, but sometimes people tell me. So I'm privy to some of what went on, but not everything. So
I mean, it was a very interesting time. I mean, and there were so many other things that you know, we've not covered that, you know, it's incredible what we've been through. And I think people don't get their head around the fact that, you know, although we are in League Two, the fact is we're in League Two. And who would have thought all those years ago that would be possible? Not only are we in League Two, but thanks to your leadership, in a way, we're at Plough Lane, which is an incredible stadium. And we always say one of the things is that whenever I go there and we look around and we go, well, we kind of built this, you know, and
you say it like that, because it isn't. I feel incredibly uncomfortable when people stop me and thank me for what I did, because and I always say, because I genuinely believe it, it's a whole pile of people did all sorts of things. And probably you could do another series of unsung heroes of AFC Wimbledon who ought to get there. And I'm sorry, couldn't think of others, although I do think Eileen's pretty deserving. to pick out.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And to this day, there's some amazing people. I had we do our sort of like club person of the year, and last year we gave it to Mandy Bynan, who's just always replies constantly. Yeah. Whatever time you send an email, she always replies to you. Fantastic. But there's another Mandy who works on the reception desk all the time.
Mandy Archer, I think she's called. Mandy,
and she's fantastic. She's great. I went to the club recently, and you know, she's brilliant as well. So we've got all these wonderful unsung heroes. And there's the guy who does the Phil, who does the security. I remember he was the one of the first people I met when we went down to King's Meadow. And he's got So there
are. Oh, you reminded me about the time the stewards went on strike, but that's probably for another time.
Damn it.
So this is the book. I don't episode think Eric Samuelson episode one.
That's right. He
exactly.
He gets promoted from Eric Samuel to Eric Samuelson in the next episode.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, Samuelsons. It's absolute. It's been fascinating. And I'm going to ask this one last question before we let you go. What isn't in the book that you'd like to put in?
Well, it's got some mistakes, I'm told, so I'd like to correct them.
A big section on Matthew's book, Matthew's play.
I wish I'd had notice of that question too. Off the top of my head, nothing strikes me. There is another book to be written about the club, which I'd quite like to write, about a part of the club. And I occasionally talk to the club about it and in principle get agreement that then it stalls, probably through my indolence. But off the top of my head, no. But I'll drop you an email sometime when they come back to me, as they surely will. When I wake in the night, I'll think, oh yeah, I should have said that.
What's the second book you're thinking of?
I'd rather not say it because somebody else might want to write it. And I want to write it. So.
Oh, okay.
I'll tell you offline, but I'm not going public.
Yeah. So anyhow, there's another book from Eric.
No. The I'd like to. That's different.
There's another book from Eric. And also he has that film script, which one point I just need to see. It just sounds fascinating.
It's not very good.
And it ends with the penalty shootout, I'm assuming.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's got a little coda at the end, the way these things always do with something sort of sentimental that'll bring tears to the eyes of lovers of young people and sentimental, sort of sentimental Disney-ish slushy.
Yeah, I love it. I'm excited. It's fantastic. Well, I thought he was a slushy. I was in bits at Manchester.
Were you?
Yeah, I was that beating Luton. I was. It just felt for me. It felt like we'd done it. I mean, it was just amazing. I mean, like Plough Lane was incredible as well. But that experience
when that ball hit the net from Danny Kidwell.
Yeah,
that will live me for a very very long time.
And I think there's something missing in me because. I was completely calm all the way through. I really was. I mean, as you see in the book, Eileen was hiding in the loo in the next cubicle to Josie Guy, as she found out later. But I was just completely calm. And the first thing I thought of when we won, was to go over and talk to the Luton directors and give them my commiserations because they've been so helpful to us in our rise to the leagues. And they were so gracious. And similarly, when I look at Plough Lane, I think, yeah, that's a nice stadium. I don't really relate it to me in any way at all. Or what happened at Main Road, as I insist on calling it. I know it's not. Yeah. City of Manchester Stadium. So I think I'm missing out somehow. I didn't experience that surge of emotion that you guys clearly did. I think that's a great shame.
Eric, we're well over time, and we should have wrapped up ages ago, but I'm going to ask you, what about the Staines playoff? Because I think for me, that is actually the most important game in our history.
Actually, that's one of the times I did get emotional. I said in the book about several minutes to go, I turned to Ivor and said, I think this is slipping away. And then, let me see, Lewis Cumbers equalised, I think. Lewis Cumbers equalised. And they were ranting about a foul on the keeper, but it wasn't. I've watched it several times.
Yeah, there are loads of times.
There's a film, it must be from Football Hurts. It must have been.
Nuts TV, and it's called Football Hurts.
Football Hurts.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, I've watched that hundreds of times.
There's a season summary on YouTube. So I watched that. And then Mark DiBolla got the winner. The two things it did. First of all, my sister's lives in a football family. She's not particularly into football herself, but her husband and her two sons are all mad keen on football from the Northwest. And I sent her a text, and it just said, "We won, we won, we won, we won." I think it said seven or eight times. And then I was standing just looking out at it, thinking, this is great, and listening to somebody in the boardroom grumbling about our fans being on the pitch and ruining it. And then I got a text. My younger son was in the middle of the pitch, and I think I picked him out later. And he just sent me this text that said, "Well done, Dad." And that really got to me. It really did. Far more than anything else. Because you want the respect of your children, and you very rarely get it when you've got teenage kids. So I like that. Yeah, that was probably the highlight of that match for me. That bit.
Oh, that's beautiful, and what a beautiful way to end. And Eric, there are so many more questions that I'd love to ask. Anyhow.
Well, buy me lunch, and I'll tell you.
Yeah, we will. We'll buy you those pints of lemonade. But thank you so much, Eric Samuelson.
Thank you.
As I said at the beginning. And thank you to Niall Cooper and to Adam Proctor. This time we didn't chat about the match on Saturday, but we won and we still go on. Who knows what happens next, but we've had just the best time talking to Eric. It's been fantastic. Thank you so much. Thank you, Niall. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
We are the Same Old Wombles. We're back.